Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to another edition of the Tom Jennings Audio Archives. I am Tom Jennings, a music writer for the Niagara Gazette in Niagara Falls, New York, near Buffalo. This week I have something that's not that old, but we'll still call it an archived interview. It's an interview that I did with the legendary rocker Todd Rundgren. Those of you that know me know that I'm a huge Todd Rundgren fan. I'm a veteran of over 140 shows. So in this interview, it's a little bit hard for me not to geek out too much. Todd and his music have been a really important part of my life. Todd Rundgren and Utopia opened the window to so many other bands, and really my love of music is one constant that kept from my youth and still enjoy listening to all their great music. This is the sixth time that I've been, and I don't think I will ever run out of questions. But as you'll hear, Todd was very generous with his time, very open with his answers. We talk about what's going on presently in terms of his autobiography, the White Knight Tour, and the upcoming Todd Stock event. Anyhow, I hope you enjoy this interview with the legendary Todd Rundgren. I know Todd's fans love every interview that they can get their hands on, so I hope that they enjoy this one in particular. But even if you're a casual fan, I think there's some great stuff in here. So without any further ado, my talk with Todd Rundgren.
Should be connected.
All right, great.
Yellow.
Hi, Todd. As always, an honor and a pleasure to speak with you. Appreciate you taking the time today.
No problem.
All right. First question is just the mundane one. This is for a preview for the upcoming show at the Rapids Theater in Niagara Falls for these upcoming winter dates. Similar to the White Knight Tour with the screen, or what's the difference and what's the similarities?
It's going to be mostly the same. Musically, it'll be pretty much the same, and we will have video projection, and we'll have a slightly different setup than we had in the spring. The spring, we had two whole video walls, one in front and one behind the band, and that proved in the long run to be somewhat prohibitive, both in terms of the expense and the time it took to set it up, but the size of venue that we could play as well. So we modified the show to allow us to get into a greater variety of venues while at the same time bringing what is substantially the same show.
And I mean, you toured with this kind of scaled back set with Yestival, getting in front of some new audiences. Were you pleased with the reactions? I mean, it looked like the reviews online were all excellent.
It was good for us. It worked out pretty well. You know, we actually got the sweet spot in the show, which is the second spot. You know, you're not the opener, so you're not waiting for everybody to find their seats. And you're not the closer, wherein everyone is sort of getting up before the end of the show to get out to the parking lot and escape. So, you know, we had kind of the maximum, amount of audience right at a point, I think, where everyone's interest was kind of focused, because, like I say, it's right in the sweet spot in the show. So it worked out really well for us.
So do you think on some level, you introduced a lot of new material, relatively speaking. I mean, most of it was, some of it goes back, 20-some-odd years. But in terms of classic rock people, they tend to think that anything after 1980 is new. But do you think maybe you dispelled the notion that an artist can't go out and present new material and it'll resonate with audiences?
Well, you hope that it'll, that the idea will catch on, because I've been doing it, forever. And I don't have such a big catalog of hit songs that I could make a whole set out of them anyway. So my audience has to be already cognizant of the fact that I am probably going to do something different and possibly beyond your expectations. Sometimes they do something and it falls beneath the audience's expectations, like they were definitely hoping for something else. But, when it works, it's kind of like the culmination of me acclimating my audience to the idea that you don't know what the show is exactly going to be about from tour to tour, and that's kind of like the point for me, trying new things that helps me kind of keep a youngish attitude, and hopefully that translates to the audience and helps them feel like, not like a bunch of old people sitting there watching a bunch of old people, you know, but more like, you know, us all kind of like reliving our youth.
Well, that, you know, that actually leads nicely into my next question, talking about reliving your youth. I understand you're putting the finishing touches on your autobiography. You're not one that's known, like you said, for really getting too steeped in the past. I mean, you revisited on occasion the Wizard of True Star shows and some other things like that. But what was that process like? And maybe as you looked back over your career, was there anything that, you know, maybe you either regretted or just kind of looked back and said, man, those were great eras, or, you know, anything like that?
Well, the actual process of writing was somewhat difficult for me. Not that I can't write, but it reminded me of homework, being back in school. And that, you know, kind of immediately made things more difficult for myself in that regard. So it took a lot of kind of self-discipline to get through the process, because when I'm writing music or something like that, it's kind of just consign a lot of it to your subconscious. You think about what the song might be about, you mull it over in your brain, and then at some point it all springs out fully realized. But, you know, trying to remember facts, now that's another thing, you know, trying to remember like exactly what happened and in what order and things like that kind of hurts my brain sometimes.
Yeah, and I guess that makes sense, because again, you're not somebody that has necessarily, you know, really gotten stuck in your past, and I think there's a part of your life that's a bit of a mystery to your fans, and I think we're all interested to see how you've approached this work.
Well, I try to make it as easy as possible for the reader. I try to make a book like that I would want to read. Often when somebody writes a memoir, it comes out like stream of consciousness, and it's a big mishmash of things that actually happened, things that you remember but maybe happened differently, your emotional response to them, all of that kind of comes out at once. And I decided that I wanted to try and separate those components out in a way. So, like, the first, every chapter is a page. So you could open the book anywhere and just start reading, and it wouldn't depend on having read something previous. You could kind of get through a page, and it would be a whole kind of anecdote or story, or sometimes it's about somebody that I met who had a significant impact on my life and that sort of thing. But I try and, in the first paragraph, just kind of tell what happened without kind of muddying it up with my reactions to what's going on. And then in the second paragraph, I address that. I address the, you know, the issues of, you know, what am I feeling about all this. And then finally, there'll be a brief paragraph about whatever lessons I may have learned, and therefore what people's takeaway should be from that particular episode. So I tried to make it, you know, like I would like to read it. You know, I would like, if I wanted to, I could just read all the top paragraphs, and it would just be what factually happened, and it wouldn't be muddied up with a bunch of, you know, other sorts of impressions. Then again, if you'd wanted to read just, you know, the purely subjective aspect of it, you would only read the second paragraph and skip the facts.
Yeah, I mean, I absolutely can't wait to read it. We've been waiting a long time for this book, and I know a lot of the fans like myself are excited to see your take on things, and again, look at some of the pieces of your history that maybe we missed that lend a little bit.
Well, it's pretty much finished. We're just trying to figure out a publishing date for it. We're doing the, you know, spelling corrections now and stuff. So.
Well, you've got a milestone birthday coming up, 70. I'm one of the lucky ones that didn't get waitlisted for the new
God. God. Well, we're trying to address that. You know, part of the issue, the last time we did this, there was like no warning. You know, I just got it into my head to do it. And 200 to 300 people showed up, and it just happened to work out. You know, it turned out to be everything everyone expected. And so the hardest thing ever since then has been recreating that whole sort of ad hoc vibe, that Burning Man vibe. And in the past 10 years, we've done fan camps and stuff where we go to a resort and everyone stays in a hotel room and we all eat food that the resort prepares and stuff like that, which was not what happened in the first one. The first one was like all volunteer. We cooked for each other. We built things. We built like our own bars and things to hang out in, competing bars. One only served martinis, the other only served Mai Tais, you know, and played it by ear pretty much the whole time. And everyone had the best time, you know, as opposed to some of the other ones where we had to have, you know, activities and stuff like that. So the biggest challenge has been trying to recreate what just sort of accidentally happened the first time. And we wanted to give everyone an opportunity, but apparently giving people too much time opened the door to a lot of disappointment, you know. In other words, if we had only announced it like a month or so beforehand, which was about how much time we gave everyone for, about 2 months maybe. And so everyone like quickly made a snap decision and did it. And if you didn't make a snap decision, well, you know, it's just, you didn't know what was going to happen anyway. But this year, yeah, we're going to take over a small town in Virginia. We're going to essentially do our best to recreate that original Todstock vibe.
Yeah, I mean, I'm thinking probably the participation level is much different, not only because of the time, but even East Coast. I mean, you certainly have a presence on the West Coast. You live in San Francisco, and you know, you've lived in Hawaii for quite some time now. But, man, that East Coast fan base, I mean, they've been with you for a very long time.
Well, we did this in an interesting way. We kind of just opened it to proposals because we knew that doing it on Kauai, while authentic in some ways, would be a problem for a lot of people getting out there. It's expensive, far away, and the travel, you know, alone might make it prohibitive for people. So we decided to do it at where at least everyone could drive to. Now the next issue is, you know, how do we accommodate those people who got disappointed and are now waitlisted? And we're entertaining the possibility of yet another event, maybe close to the West Coast or something like that. We had also originally announced that if someone wanted to help us do it in a completely other territory, that we would be happy to do that as well. And I think right now we're discussing the possibility of doing something in Europe, potentially Scotland or Holland. And in the very germinal stages of discussing something that would be in the Pacific Rim, like possibly Australia. So if you didn't make the first one, you know, you couldn't make another one. We're just still trying to figure that out.
Well, it's got to feel good, though, that you've got this. I mean, if you think about it, in 10 years, your fan base, I think it's grown. I mean, even just from my perspective, and it's kind of ironic. I feel like maybe in some ways the new cars was, although it didn't seem to end all that well, was a bit of a turning point to things that to better things. And here you are coming full circle. You're basically playing with that same band with, you know, Jesse Gress swapped out for Elliot, and then
for Elliot Easton. Yeah, that's occurred to us actually. You know? And I think at one point we actually got an offer to go out again as the new cars, but Elliot has been dealing with this, and he said the legal issues, the name and stuff like that, has made it kind of just prohibitive. You know, there's no easy way to do it, put it that way. And it's not as if we have some aversion to it, but it would require, I think, for Elliot to be able to participate. And, you know, he says that while musically it's an entertaining idea, we don't really want to get into another legal kind of issue, because that's kind of how the original Cars thing ended up. Issues with trying to get the name, the accident that Elliot had where he broke his collarbone and we had to sort of prematurely end our debut tour, and we weren't able to really put everything back together again in order to continue after that. So much as there is that looming possibility, the fact that we've got, you know, 4/5 of the new cards, getting that fifth, you know, it just doesn't seem to be in the cards. So,
Well, musically, I mean, this is an incredible outfit, and I love John Forensic, and he played with you a lot of years. I mean, great guys, but man, Greg Hawks it's just got to be a lot of fun playing with him. He just brings a lot to the table.
He does, you know. He plays saxophone as well, which John did not, and that's not necessarily a requirement. It was just, you know, a fringe benefit that we got out of it. Yeah, Greg and I have, in particular, gotten along really well, you know, especially since, you know, he and I weren't from the West Coast when we were putting together the New Cars thing. And so we wound up rooming together in Malibu for a couple of weeks and eating our dinners together and stuff like that. So he and I got pretty close during that period, and that's why, you know, a reason why he's kind of our go-to guy now, because he just kind of fits in, you know. It's just kind of doesn't require a lot of thought or meshing or any of that sort of stuff.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's a fantastic band. I'm certain that I don't need to tell you that. You know, a couple more questions. I know we're coming up on the 25-minute mark. Particular songs over the years that you've had, I guess for lack of a better term, it seemed to have like a closer relationship with them than others. I'll start out with Just One Victory. I mean, that's a song that is just such an incredible concert moment for the fans. I mean, over the years, I'm sure there's songs that maybe you kind of step away from and maybe get a little sick of playing because that's just natural. I mean, how has it been over the years with Just One Victory? Is that a song that really still resonates with you as much as it does with some of the diehards?
Well, it's technically, I guess you would say, it's my first anthem. I've written so-called anthems after that, but it was the first one. And I don't even know that I was thinking anthem when I was writing it. It was just, it evolved into that over time. And I still perform it. It's actually part of the White Knight show. And it does seem to be something that, regardless of what has happened during the show, if I play that song at the end, all is forgiven. So I think that more than anything, you know, whether it has, well, it certainly does have a certain amount of meaning in today's context when we're dealing with a maniac in power. So the idea of resistance, which is essentially what the song is about, has some currency today, and I think the song can speak to whatever it is that that people are feeling about the current situation. At the same time, you know, it was written so long ago that you sort of wonder, does anything ever change?
Yeah.
But that, you know, having said that, you know, it's part of what you do. You know, you keep your powder dry. You keep your little pilot light going for the moment when you have to actually, you know, take the bushel off of your candle, whatever it is, you know, that biblical allegory. But the time to do it, and unfortunately, as much as I encourage people to do it, sometimes they don't heed my advice, is when there's a candidate at the polls, you know, and you go out and vote for them. I mean, the visual that a song like Just One Victory evokes is very militant, but ideally you accomplish these things by the way that you live day to day, by concerted effort and becoming an example of something. And so the concept of Just One Victory, you know, a battle in which you win everything, it really isn't what I believe in the first place, because the idea of the song is just one victory and we're on our way. In other words, it's not the last thing that you have to do.
Right.
It's only the first thing you have to do.
Yeah, no, that makes complete sense. Second one, Love of the Common Man. You know, you've revisited that in different forms and everything. It always seems to work. I don't know what it is about that song. It was one of the first songs that I heard by you that really I just really loved it. You must love it too, because I mean, you've brought it out on a lot of tours and everything. I know it's not in the current set list and everything, but What was it about that song that you loved playing, and maybe what was the kind of the impetus behind that one as well?
Well, it's kind of the straight aheadness of it in a way. You know, the basic simplicity of the song, yet it has some, you know, signature things that are kind of like the way I would do it. You know, kind of, there's certain changes and structures and stuff that are a little bit out of the ordinary, and they can often signify a song that I've written. You can tell that I've written it by certain things that are in it. And so while it's simple, and I always often find it difficult to write simple songs, they're the hardest thing to do because you don't know when to stop. You don't know when you've written enough sometimes. So a song like Bang the Drum, I had to dream that in order to be able to write it, because if I had consciously sat down to write it, it would have turned into something else. So a song like Common Man, to me, it's the simplicity about it, you know, the fact that I don't need a lot of augmentation to play it myself. I can just stand up with a guitar and do it. I have a few songs like that, and I have the same sort of warm feelings for them because it makes it easier for me to perform. But beyond that, I'm really, in that particular case, I'm really happy with the way that the song came out from a songwriter's standpoint, and that's one of the reasons why I like to do it.
Yeah, as you should be. Well, we're at 25 minutes. You know, thanks to Paul, obviously, for setting this up again. And I don't know if I ever have properly thanked you for creating the soundtrack of my life and bringing me a lot of joy in your music and bringing this fan community together that's meant so much to me. They're like a second family. You know, we come together in times of crisis, but we sure as hell know how to party when we're having a good time, too.
Yeah. We got family values.
We got family. We absolutely. God, that's an amazing album, The Individual. I just listened to Temporary Sanity came up on my playlist today, and with all the shootings, I was thinking to myself, my God. Yeah, you're right. These songs, they never get old. It's just they seem to... The themes that were around in
you
the
wish
90s.
They would, yeah.
Yeah.
You kind of wish they would, yeah. But.
Yeah, very intense.
All right.
So.
Well, I guess I'll see you at Todstock.
You will see me at Todstock. You will hopefully we'll get a chance to pop back and say hello to you at the Rapids Theater as well. And, you know.
Okay, cool.
Looking forward to it. Thanks so much, Todd.
My pleasure. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.